Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
Ladies and gentlemen, please fasten your seatbelts, strap in, and join me in welcoming Mary Carr to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Thank you. I'm very overstimulated. Too excited. Thank you. Thank you so much. Great introduction. One reason I'm so excited, my nephew lives here. I've been on the road for, you know, almost 3 weeks. And my nephew, I wanted to just give a shout out to my sister's son, Kay Scaglione, who's the music director and conductor of the Youth Foundation, the Young Musicians Foundation Debut Orchestra, who just won the Aspen Prize in conducting, Kay Scaglione. Raise your hand. He's going to be more famous. He's already more famous than I am, compared to the young Dudamel. And my best friend since high school, Dooney. He's the only guy here, I bet, with a NASCAR jacket. Where are you? There you are. There you are. So this is feeling like I'm being interviewed by a memoirist who's also an ex-drunk and a Catholic is a big win. So thank you all for being here. I had this idea when I left home. I left home with Dooney. I got in a truck with these heads and surfers and to head out to California because, as Dooney said, all the loose marbles roll west. And it was the 70s. And if you remember the 70s, you were not there. And I had this great idea that in the Liars Club, if you haven't read it, is about my eccentric childhood, my hard-drinking, well-armed parents, my seven-times-married mother. Cherry was about my drug-sodden adolescence. But when Dooney and I left with our four other friends, I had this great idea that I could just, you know, leave all that behind. I thought, those suckers have seen the last of me. It's a great idea you get, right, when you go to college. You're going to go there and you'll be this whole new person. Only I wasn't going to college. I was going to surf school. And I wanted to connect the dots between Liars Club and Cherry and my adult self, between the wound and the healing. I wanted to come full circle, and people had this weird idea about me. Some guy said to me when he interviewed me on TV last week, he said, "You look better than I thought you would." They made me come to get my makeup done like 2 hours before, and I said, "Really?" I said, "What did you think I would look like?" And he said, "Some bedraggled slattern." I was like, "Oh my goodness." But people have this idea that I walked out of this complicated background and just went zippity-doo-dah down Literary Lane. And I had a lot of help. So had a lot of luck. I had a lot of friends. One thing that happened to me that I write about in this book was I met this big 6'5" Harvard hockey player who looked like something you win at a raffle. He actually looked like that guy who played Superman, right? He actually looked like him. He could quote more Shakespeare than anybody I knew. And when my sister met him, she said, he might as well walk out with his hands up. It's all over for him. Little did I know when he brought me home, again, I'm from this redneck Texas backwater, that he's from this aristocratic Long Island polo-playing blue blood family. It was a... So we start winding through these big wrought iron gates with gold leaf at the top. And I said, is this a subdivision? We were passing the stables and the tennis courts. And he said, no, this is my house. And I said, which, you know, in some ways, I said, why didn't you tell me about all this? He said, about all what? Which in some ways, I think, made him the perfect husband for me, right? Because the average well-bred American wasp can ignore reality better than any heroin addict. Plus, they won't steal your television. Like, they had a dog named Tiger that when you come in and the maid, there's a maid in, like, a uniform, which was just comical to me. It was like Green Acres or something. And they had this dog waggling around Tiger, and I said, oh, my God, that dog must be, you know, 25 years old. You had him since you were a baby. Well, when Tiger 1 died, they got Tiger 2. Tiger 2 died, they got Tiger 3. So these people lived, occupied a universe in which the dog never dies. And I think they found the solution, right? And strangely enough, he wanted to marry me. And I just thought he was the anti-venom to the snake bite of who I was. Now, you would think with a 7 times married mother, I would have a little help in the wedding planning department. But my mother responded to weddings strongly, kind of like, you know, Vietnam vets having flashbacks of Khe San. You know, it's like she throws herself on the ground and screams, incoming, you know. The minute she hears, here comes the bride. So she decided at my wedding, where she's meeting all these rich people, to fall off the wagon. So she wasn't exactly on the wagon. You know, my sister and I had said, you know, you have to stop drinking or we won't associate with you. And in return, she got a Valium prescription, some cable, some back pills, a little sleeping pill, something for my nerves. And she decides to start drinking at my wedding, at my rehearsal dinner. So that's what I'm going to read. We'll read for about 10 minutes, and then I'm very excited to have questions asked. The occasion for Mother falling off the wagon is the afternoon of my rehearsal dinner at the Ritz in Boston, where my father-in-law-to-be has kept a tab since law school. Before the rehearsal dinner, I'm lying in a shampoo chair with my head in the black sink, neck arched upward in a perfect position to have my throat cut, when I catch a distant whiff of marijuana. Mother, I think. With that single word, an unease comes shimmering into my solar plexus. I say to Richard, my stylist, they've closed the salon for us. Do you smell that? I say. What? He says. Pot, I say. Lifting his nose in the air, he gives a stuffed up snuffle and says, allergies. It's dusk. I've warned Richard and his beautician colleague, Curtis, in advance not to offer Mother and me their usual convivial glass of wine. Twice. After not so long, Curtis swans in, giving off an odor of patchouli oil as he rifles a drawer. He says, your mom's a riot. I'm going to visit her in Texas. She knows a place I can buy ostrich skin cowboy boots. I'm sure she does, I say. Sometime later, when Curtis presents her, I see he's jacked her hair up into a concoction only a drag queen could relish. Her eyes are glassy. Her neck has this bobble-headed swivel. Mother, I say, don't I look precious, she says, hands on her hips. You look high. Do you think, Curtis says, she made me do it that high. Mother tips her head coquettishly, which with the giant hairdo has the effect of a topiary starting to topple over. She says, we smoked a little Mary Jane. Then we're in Warren's tiny back seat as he navigates the River Road traffic to the Ritz. I'm violently trying to de-escalate Mother's hair. She holds her ears as I tug. You reek of marijuana, I say. The city of Cambridge is sliding behind us. At the boathouse, we pass somebody hauling a lone skull from the water. I apologize to Warren as I work at the vast rat's nest on her head. I don't smell anything, he says. With Warren, you can never know if this is impeccable denial or politeness. I stopped yanking her hair at some point and noticed the buildings of Harvard carved from various fine types of stone slipping by like a kingdom I'll never gain the keys to. The whole city is so profoundly Caucasian. One of its signature food dishes is a slab-like whitefish devoid of all flavor. Even its basketball team is thick with knobby-jointed white guys, farm boys whose pasty torsos evoke the aforementioned fish. Mother tries to catch Warren's eye in the rear view. She says, "Warren, you've got to come to Texas and see pictures of your wife. Do you think I look bad? You got in the back so quickly I couldn't see you," he says. His eyes are fixed on the lights of Boston. "Master of diplomacy," I say. "Warren, can you hand me my purse? I'll find the Shalimar." I ask him to stop and buy some Visine and some mouthwash, maybe. "It'll make us late," he says. Warren pulls up outside a bodega and leaves us in the huffing car. Seeing his runner's form in the unfamiliar structure of a suit brings a surge of ardor. Soon as he's out of sight, Mother says, "Harold and I share a glass of wine every now and then when we go out dancing." Harold, being the somewhat prissy young man of color, hired to help care for Daddy. My father at this point is all stroked out and bedridden. And we've hired this guy, and he actually wore, I swear to God, these hot pink velvet bell bottoms that made him look like Willy Wonka. And my mother would wear these sequin tops. It was what we would later call her flash dance period. So the idea of their having a glass of wine before dancing gives me a sick feeling in my chest. I look toward the door Warren's disappeared through, his presence the antivenom to the snake bite of Mother's disarray. Warren gets back in the car, handing me a small paper bag over his shoulder. I fish through it for the eye drops. Mother has her Shalimar out and is studying the cap for where the nozzle is. I tell her, "They'll be unfailingly polite. They always are." She squirts behind her ear, and the scent of rose adder touches some reptilian area of my brain. Where lies whatever faint recollection of beauty I have? "Warren," she says, "you know what they say a mother-in-law's job is at a wedding?" "I don't," he says, pushing his glasses up his nose. "Just shut up and wear beige." He actually snorts at this prospect. Mother takes my hand and says my heart was thumping so bad I was scared to take another Valium in case there was a toast or something, because I'd probably fall into my plate. I take no comfort in sharing anxiety with my once towering mother, for any ways we favor each other on this night make me feel distinctly unbridled. Still, I show her my throat, adding, "Make me smell like you." Then we draw up into the gilded light of the Ritz, and the doorman helps us out. We enter the panel bar to find the Whitbreads, plural, 6 siblings, 2 daughters-in-law, 1 son-in-law, scattered among the low tables, the tallest people in the room, possibly the best-looking. There's a hubbub of shaken hands. A martini lands before me and gets tossed down. Drinking, to handle the angst of Mother's drinking, caused by her own angst, means our twin dipsomanias face off like a pair of mirrors, one generation offloading misery to the other through dwindling generations back through history to when humans first fermented grapes. The next thing I know, Lisa's grabbing my arm as we stride up the stairs to the table saying, "What is she on?" Then we're seated at enormous tables draped with enough linen to clothe a convent. Ultimately, it doesn't matter that my mother-in-law sobs through much of the meal, not, I'm guessing, from joy. Warren's brother asked me with genuine puzzlement as we head down the grand staircase, "You mean she was crying? I didn't notice." And I think, how do these people do this? Nor does it matter that Mother offered to paint Mr. Whitbread in the nude and, quote, "fix anything you need fixed," close quote. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Makes an excellent Christmas gift.
Mary, welcome to L.A. We're just thrilled to have you in this.
I'm so excited you're a Catholic. You don't think I'm an idiot. All these other people do.
No, I'm a total Catholic. I have my cross inside my...
Yeah, my Jewish boyfriend bought me this giant... It looks like the Pope wears this, right? You know that you're doing something right when you got your Jewish boyfriend buying you crosses this big, don't you think?
I saw the giant cross in your video trailer, or whatever they call it now that you do for books. It was this huge... Huge.
Yeah, we
don't. Where did you get that thing? It was this huge crucifix on the table.
Oh, yeah, it was Ethiopian. I got it at a flea market.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Thank you.
But it was very kind of startling. Whoa.
Startling for me. We don't crucify ourselves or anything. We like our crosses large, though.
Yeah.
You know, we're converts. What do we know?
We're fervent. No, but really, I just wanted to welcome you to our city and our library that we're so proud of. And our
you should be. This is an amazing
our
space.
Our series. And,
in New York, they have a space, you know, like about as big as this little bank of chairs, and they wedge people in there. It's very pathetic.
Okay, first I have to ask, how did you deal with your ex-in-laws? Have they read the book or...
You know, no, of course not, but they're so polite, it wouldn't matter. You know, I didn't know what my husband thought when I was sleeping with him. I mean, about that, maybe. But, no, I offered my ex-husband in advance. I do what I did with all these books. I notify people in advance. I say, this is the time I'm thinking of covering. This is what's going to be in the book. And as I said to Warren, you know, you can either vet the pages when I'm done, you know, read them yourself, or you can have a pseudonym. And he said, I prefer a pseudonym, so who knows? My son does see his Aunt Nancy. It'll be decades before they mention this. I mean, he'll probably never hear a word about it.
So, you speak to the ex-in-laws, but they would
yeah.
just... But,
yeah, we had dinner, we had a big lunch for my son's graduation. I mean, we don't hang out.
Yeah.
I don't stomp divots on the polo field with him or anything.
Okay, I'm wondering if you'll tell the story, because I'm not a Long Island blue blood, but I am a Yankee, and this whole idea of money, the whole thing
it's thrilling, isn't it?
Money that is so fraught in your marriage. This whole, even though he was loaded, that there was a lot of secrecy around money. You split your bills right down the middle to the penny. He was very reluctant to ask his parents ever for money. But there's this great, great story in the book that just kind of, I thought, emblemized the marriage. And it's about the $20, the cognac.
Oh, God.
Can you tell that story? Oh, it's a great story.
I was a bus girl. I was a bus girl in this restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts for about 3 days. I was an extremely surly bus girl. And my last night, I actually set the dining room with all knives, you know. Just had to leave a little something. But I sit down at the bar, and this guy, this waiter, who had been very surly and made fun of me because I didn't know what a fish knife was, he bought me a cognac. It was very tasty. And then the manager came by, and he bought me a cognac. And then I was feeling pretty happy about this. It was going down like silk. And I bought myself a cognac. And imagine my surprise, this is like 1980, when I get a bill for $20. And I said, that cognac was $20? Oh, my God. I mean, well, I just have to go back to work here. That's all there. I just quit. You know, that's all there is to it. Why did you like that story, though?
No, well, no.
Because I was such an idiot.
You haven't finished it. No, that you had to borrow, money from your husband.
I don't want to throw him under the bus on that so bad. You know, I had to borrow 20 bucks, and he kind of made a big deal about it.
Yeah, that was the thing that was fascinating.
Yeah, but that's a WASP thing. You know, that's how they are. I mean, that's not even a him thing. It's just, you know, they would just be very like, well, why don't you have $20? How puzzling.
And you borrowed the 20 bucks and then you gave it, but you returned it to him the next day.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, yeah, that was the least of what he did. Jesus. You know, he was not a bad guy. He was just a complete, you know, if you marry somebody to cure yourself, then they eventually become an irritant to who you are, right? Clearly a bad idea.
No, I wasn't trying to impugn his character. I just thought the whole notion of how much emotion and sort of weirdness that was around the, you know, and that you'd have to borrow the 20, but I just thought it was a very, it was beautifully done because it was so, just told so much about the marriage and about this kind of, you know, the unlikeliness and the whole, you know, where you had a great line about where I came from, there were only a few bucks and we would just kind of, so they were just got passed back and forth, like that's how money was where you grew up. So it was very, very different. But I just want to, I'm sure everyone talks about this, but you start, I mean, obviously it's a real mother-hunted book, your own mother and then your son, Dev, who's now
23.
And you open the book with a letter to him that it really struck me as kind of a love letter in a sense. And
I like him. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's amazing to me we don't eat our children before I had one. I mean, I'm serious. You know, before I actually had a kid, I didn't know that I would love it that much, you know. And it was a real shock to have to like him so much. Still do. Just crazy about him.
Mm-hmm. So you open the book with a letter to him to sort of, okay, why?
Why do I open the book with a letter to him? Well, I think in some ways, I wish I had had about the difficult times in my youth, something about my mother's point of view written closer to when it happened. Again, I don't. He doesn't read my books. He's not interested in my books. I'm like the bank of mom, right? Have buttons here, you push here, and like money comes out. So, I guess. I wanted him to have that.
You wanted him to have it. So in a way, you wrote the book for him.
I wrote it for the money. Sorry. I did. I know you only get on Oprah if you say you did it to help people, but I wrote it for money. They gave me a lot of money, too. Not enough, but some.
Well, maybe you'll make more.
That's one aspires to.
Yeah. Okay, so Warren is the name. I don't know if it's his real name, but the name of your husband in the book, and you get married to him, you have a baby, and you drink, and you drink, and you drink, and you're sort of drinking Jack Daniels, and you're living in Cambridge, right?
Cambridge, yep.
And you're sort of breaking into the literary world, but you're drinking. And then you have a bit, what precipitates your stopping finally?
Oh, God, you know, you just, you know, I don't know. It was very weird to me that I could always quit drinking. I was, you know, I was more of a binge drinker most of my life, and it's just the last two or three years that it really got away from me. But I kept trying to quit. I'd get sober for like 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, and I almost drove into this concrete that was very molecularly dense and would have harmed me a good deal. And I wound up walking home down the river road, and I've been talking to people who try to stop drinking, and they've been trying to get me to pray and have a higher power. And you've got to understand the degree to which atheism, agnosticism was imbued in my bones. It was like, I thought it was like the Easter Bunny until I was about 8. You know, I didn't even know people were serious when they said they believed in God. I thought it was just like a social convention, like putting up a Christmas tree, you know. So, yeah, but it was after that I started praying. Somebody suggested you pray on your knees morning and night for 30 days and see if your life got better. So I did that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to back up just because I think I want to get the time right. And I think you at one point taught poetry to developmentally
retarded women.
Exactly.
Basically, yeah.
So
I mean, it was called the Home for Retarded Women. That's the sign that was on it. That's what I called it. So
mm-hmm.
They were developmentally disabled in current parlance, but that's what they were called at the time. So.
And what was that like?
Oh, God, I really like them. They were, I mean, I write about it in the book. It's, they were pretty adorable. And they really, their passion for poetry, they're sort of unbridled. You know, like I remember the first day I went in, and I read them Pablo Neruda's Walking Around. And I remember that because that was what I read in the first poetry class I did everywhere. So I don't have such a remarkable memory. That was just what I did for my first class. And it begins, you know, it so happens I am sick of being a man. I'm sick of my hair and my hands and my feet and my shadow. And it goes on and it says something like, it would be marvelous to terrify a pedestrian with a lily or to kill a nun. And this one lady screams out, "Kill a nun!" and you don't know, like, if it's from enthusiasm or outrage. You can't really tell. And then when I finished reading the poem, there's for this moment of silence. And I thought, oh God, they really hate this. You know, my idea was that I would tell them things to put in their poems, and they would write, and that the staff and I would write down because they couldn't write. Most of them could maybe sign their name, and then I would type those up, and I would read them, and they would sort of participate in the language. And I mean, I finished that poem, and like they just you would have thought. You know, they had just won the Super Bowl. They just screamed and clapped and stomped their hands. You know, if they'd had pillows, they would have been hitting each other. They were just went nuts. And their unbridled love for language and for... And also, I did this weird little pseudo-experiment. I was very good friends with a scientist. One of my saints was this guy named Walt Mink, who's a professor who kind of saved me when I was an undergraduate. And... We were interested, we talked a lot about quality. I studied philosophy, I was interested in aesthetics and this idea of quality, of how you judge quality. And I used to read to them, I would read them two poems as much alike as I could find. Often I would get like a Cesar Vallejo poem and then an imitation of the Cesar Vallejo poem, and I would read both of them. And they always liked the better poem. I mean, it was like you could bring in Dickinson and an imitation of Dickinson. And there, with one exception, if one of the poems was really obtuse, but even like surrealistic poems and poems by Wallace Stevens, you think would be hard, have very hard syntax. And I really came to believe doing that. I mean, you know, like I kept a little log, and it was like 75% of the time they picked the best, the great poem, not just the okay poem. And I really began to believe with them that there was such a thing as beauty that was ineffable and enduring and recognizable, you know, whether you'd whether you were a bonehead like me or not, you know, whether you were uneducated to it. And they helped me really to make a decision to go to graduate school, I think.
Yeah, I loved that. I loved that part of the story because it says something so deep about how we, the level at which we respond to words and to rhythm and.
Plus, when I gave a poetry reading, they would all come on the bus. And you've never had any fun until you've had, like, 38 retarded women at your poetry reading. Because usually, it's like you and I was just saying, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to go out there. There'll be three people out there, and I've slept with two of them, you know. And so it was good. It was, you know, they could fill a room. And Katie Budke would sit on the front row every time, and after almost every poem, she would say, "You're a monkey face!" like this at me. Which I say in the book is probably the most accurate review I ever got. And then at the end of the reading, and this happened, I bet they went to 6 or 7 readings over like a 4-year period. At the end of the reading, she'd stand up and do like this operatic bow. They were just a hoot. That was a lot. It's the most fun I've had. Maybe coaching Little League was that much fun, but that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was a lovely passage. Okay, so then you got sober, and interestingly, to me a bit, you went into a psych ward after you had been sober for a little bit.
Yeah, you know, what I say in the book is it's not so much that I went crazy when I stopped drinking as I awoke to the existing insanity. I was really depressed. I didn't go interestingly crazy like Girl Interrupted crazy, Angelina Jolie crazy. You know, I was just moving, you know, the icons on the Monopoly board real slow, you know, very depressed. And really, I'd been depressed my whole life. And I loved the mental Marriott. I did. I love the mental institution. Not only does it have endless comic possibilities, as does being a Catholic. There's just funny stuff about both those events. I mean, starting in the mental institution with the green slippers they give you with the happy faces on the ends of the toes. I'm like, why are they doing this to us? They're so mean. I liked it. It wasn't a snake pit. You know, everybody just wanted to talk to you about your feelings. And I was there for 3 weeks, and it was a place I really surrendered in a way. I think I finally decided to give this whole spiritual thing a try. I mean, I would have gone to Lourdes at this point. You know, I would have. Somebody said, swing a chicken around your head with a cut throat. You know, I would have done that. Because I just knew that I was nuts, that it was, you know, the problem wasn't just the drinking. I wasn't hallucinating, think you're Napoleon nuts. I was just, I had a very Kafkaesque kind of outlook and disposition. I was no Richard Simmons. Let's put it that way.
So you got out of the mental Marriott, and you had begun to pray, and you found this kind of community of other people who are getting sober, trying to stay sober, and then you start going around to churches, and I thought it was kind of lovely that your son, who was 8 at the time, it was more or less at his behest.
I would never, if you had even told me I would go to a church other than carried by handles, you know, I would have laughed myself cockeyed. But my son came to me one morning and said, I want to go to church. And I said, why? And he said, to see if God's there, which was a very serious reason to want to go. And I felt obligated, even though we prayed, but I mean, again, it was this kind of hippie, new agey, kind of like a force for good. I was doing reverence to a force for good. And the fact that I was able to stay sober when I started praying on my knees morning and night, I just thought my big smart brain had hypnotized me, and I was having biofeedback, I think, or something like that. I had a very vague idea. I knew it worked. You know, I was very practical. So I just thought, I'll keep doing this. So we prayed. He prayed. I prayed with him. He said, I want to see if God's here. So we did this thing called God-a-rama, where we take anybody we knew had any kind of spiritual practice. They would take us, you know. And we went to churches and zendos, a conservative temple, you know, reform temple. We went to a midrash, a zendo. You've never seen an ill fit for an 8-year-old until you've taken him to a zendo, by the way. That's some harsh stuff, man. You know, try to get him to sit still. You know, he hated that part. So I knew we weren't going to make it as Buddhist. But I would have thought, you know, that one of the liberal churches would have, you know, maybe the Unitarians or the Jews or something. If you hadn't had to, you know. But the truth was, I brought a paperback and a mug and a thermos when we went, just like I did to soccer games, because I wasn't looking for a church. I was looking for him to find a church, a place where he felt comfortable. And Tobias Wolff, a great memoirist, fiction writer, had been a friend of mine since I was 22, and a grad student under him, and he was my colleague at Syracuse. He and his wife went to a Catholic church. And this was like a couple, maybe 18 months into this whole enterprise, before I went with Toby and his family. That tells you how unlikely it was, because he's somebody I saw every week. And I'd meet students who went to Southern Baptist churches, you know, and I would go. Those are some long prayers, too. If you ever go to a Southern Baptist church, they pray for a very long time. It's hard to keep up. But I would never have thought we became Catholic. It was just the last thing. Thing I would have figured. Not the Pope's favorite Catholic, I have to say. Not hired to represent the church in any way. Not a member of Opus Dei.
But you did become Catholic. And just briefly, how did that happen?
You know, I struggled against it for a very long time because I really hated the hierarchy. I hated close communion. I hated that women weren't priests. All kinds of things about the doctrine that I didn't like. But I was very moved by the faith of the people. It wasn't the majesty of the Mass or the ritual, which I actually initially found kind of tedious. But it was, you know, like when they would do their intentions, everybody would stand up in this little parish and they would say, you know, pray for my mother who's having cancer surgery, or I want to give a prayer of thanksgiving. My son came back from Afghanistan safely. And to see people bring their hopes and fears into a community really changed the way people's faces looked to me in that community. I mean, I walked in, I just thought, who are these people? And I stopped feeling that way because, again, I was very moved by their faith. You know, Jerry Berrigan also went to that church. Y'all might, those of you who don't remember the 70s, might remember Jerry Berrigan was a Vietnam protester. So there were some different kinds of people in the parish, but it was a really regular church. It wasn't an outlaw renegade church by any, it was a little Irish priest. And I actually struggled. I got kicked out of the RCIA, the adult initiation. I got kicked out. I had a big fight with a lady who did RCIA. I had to miss a bunch of them because a book was being published. I had to go on the road and travel, and she said, well, you can't be baptized at Easter if you have to miss, you know, four classes. I said, I've read all this doctrine. I've read Hans Kung. You know, I've read, you know, Summa Theologica. You know, you're not going to let me. She said, well, it's to be introduced to the church is what these classes are about. So I've been going here for years. Everybody knows. I make Advent wreaths with the kids, you know. So you're going to deny me the sacrament of baptism because I have a job? You know, you need a job. No, it was not pretty. So the priest handed me over to Toby, you know, figuring Toby could deal with it. Let Toby deal with it. So I would meet with Toby and we would talk because I still didn't get Jesus. I didn't get the whole Jesus thing. I thought he was very sappy and creepy. And I didn't like him. And God, I thought, was an amateur, even though I prayed. And I had a sense of this force for good, but the Holy Spirit, I could kind of get with that. It was vague enough for me. And I kicked and struggled. And the week before Holy Saturday, when we were baptized and I was confirmed, I was still saying to Toby, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be baptized. And he said, let me ask you something. He said, you believe in open communion. I said, yes, I don't understand how you have dinner and don't invite people. I don't see how we have to protect Jesus from these people. You know, I don't get that. He said, so when you travel, you go to Mass. I said, yeah, I do. I often go to Masses overseas or in other cities. He said, why don't you just take communion? You know, those priests don't know if you're Catholic or not. Why wouldn't you just take communion? I said, oh, my God, I would never do that. And he said, why? I said, it would be insulting to the people, you know, who have committed their lives to this faith and, you know, who believe this. It would be, like, really an awful insult to them and disrespectful. And he said, so that is sacred to you. And it really gave me pause because I realized that it really was. I had the sense of, you know, the way that I had a sense that we were all Americans even when George Bush was president. You know, I had a sense, you know, I had that sense of being Catholic. So, yeah, and then my kid told me this really great thing about the crucifixion. I don't even know if I remember if I put this in the book. I don't read these after I write them. But after we were baptized, we were looking at the crucifix one day after church. He was playing, and the kids are running around. I'm supposed to be watching them. And I'm just looking at the crucifix thinking, this really is awful. This is so porn, so porno, this whole butchering this guy. And I don't get it. And Dev was trying to get his shoe off. And he's sitting down next to me. And I said, I don't get this crucifixion thing. He said, what about it? I said, if you have to be redeemed, why don't you make it something nice? You know, like you have to say jump rope rhymes and then you're poof, you're redeemed. I mean, why not make it pleasant and or have food or something, you know? And he said, no, who would pay attention to that? He said, this is like Pulp Fiction. My mother permitted him at age 9 with my nephew then age, you know, 13, to watch Pulp Fiction because my mother said my son was interested in nonlinear filmmaking. And said he's interested in porn too, Mother. We don't show. But anyway, he said it's like Pulp Fiction, you know. Nobody would pay any attention unless it was something really gory like this. It's like, he said, like, we had all our sins washed away, and that's a really, really big deal, and nobody paid any attention to that. It's just nothing, like it was nothing. And It was the first time that idea, like I always hated the idea of, you know, Jesus going, look what I did for you, you know, that whole guilt suffering thing. And it was the first time I understood, or I had some even faint understanding of the notion of a sacrifice for me, because people are so venal that is what we pay attention to, right? Mm-hmm. So, strange. So, yeah, my Catholicism. I know it's embarrassing. I know many of you think I'm a fool. But it's such a win for me. I'm so much better Catholic. Dooney, I mean, yeah. Case, testify. Y'all testify. Anybody who's ever had to ride the subway with me before I was Catholic or after I was Catholic, it really is, it's really necessary for me. It's been a big improvement. It's something I needed. It's a crutch. Somebody said to me in my English department, you know, that's a crutch religion. I was like, absolutely. See how I limp and walk and, you know, I need it.
The book opens with the letter to your son, and then it more or less ends with your mother. And to me, I cried at a bunch of places in the book, but to me, really the most powerful passage in the book is very near the end, and it's when you and your sister have finally sold your mother's kind of moldering house, and she's getting on, and you move her to this condo outside Houston, I think, and you've spent the day cleaning out all her, lugging out her stuff, and you're exhausted.
And who came and helped me clean out my house? Dooney. Dooney and John Cleary, the first boy I ever kissed. Dooney came, they got a truck and a bunch of guys, cleaned out my house. God love him.
Yay, Dooney.
I love you, brother.
So anyway, you clean out the house, and then it's kind of late, and you go back to spend the night with your mother.
Yeah, and I had this huge fight with my mother. I mean, the context of this that's more interesting to me is that I did the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius, which is what Jesuits do. They do them over 30 days. The lay people can do them over 30 weeks. And they're it's a series of prayer techniques and meditations. The reason I did them, partly one of my best friends, a guy I played racquetball with, who was an Olympic swim coach, got to the Olympics after he did the spiritual exercise. He had two girls in the Olympics, one gold medaled. And I'm completely serious. John did. And he said, I developed this real sense of Jesus. And I had noticed by this time in the church, everybody who was really cool and seemed realistic was talked about Jesus all the time. They were very Christo-centered in their faith. And I just had no sense of Jesus. He just seemed like somebody not to be like, you know. You'd be so vulnerable all the time. And so I wanted that sense. And so one of the things I've been doing was praying over Lent. Over Lent, you pray for this number of weeks. You Jews have one day, right? We have weeks. Pay retail. Even in atonement, we pay retail. And you pray to know your sinfulness and all its ugliness. And they warn you in advance. I had a spiritual director who's a Franciscan nun, and they say this is often a very dark time, and very strange things happen between now and Easter. I said, oh, my God. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, the adversary sees you as a tasty little morsel. I said, Jesus Christ. Sister Maurice, I said, if I see a guy with like a long scaly tail and red horns, I'll shake my rosary at him, you know. What do you mean? She said, just you should be very careful because it's a very dark time. And it was true in the prayer that it was a very arid time for me in prayer. But I was feeling good that day because we'd done all this stuff and Dooney and Bob had helped me go out and had a big steak. Remember that guy was giving you the stink eye? You said, what do you... It was about buying a shirt from Penny's. It was very funny. But I was driving back to Houston thinking, I've done this good deed for my aging mother. And I got in, and she started screaming and yelling at me. And it was almost like she became, you know, her flame-haired self, and I was like my little girl self. And said, I feel like your sister, and you have raped me, and you've taken everything I hold dear. And she was shrieking at me. And I lit into her. And I don't even remember exactly what I said because I was in a, you know, readout. But I just said every horrible thing I could think up to say. And I thought, well, this is it. This is my sinfulness and all its ugliness. This is the ability to take an 80-year-old woman who's confused and, you know, rip into her. That's it. That's it, isn't it? Right? And I had these horrible nightmares all that night. And I had been given by Sister Maurice these prayers. One was Psalm 51 from the Hebrew Bible. One was from the Greek Bible. And in the morning, when I opened my mother's Bible, the first one, the Psalm, was marked in blue chalk. I was given 13 verses, and 12 of them were marked. And I thought, that's a real coincidence, isn't it? Isn't that odd? And then when I turned to the other prayer, this is in my mother's Bible from 1922, by the way. I turned to the other prayer later on, and it's marked in blue chalk. And nothing else is marked. And as I say in the book, it's not like, you know, having a bullet go in this side of your helmet and come out the back and you're okay. You know, it's not a white light moment for me. But a million things like that happened to me that felt so coincidental. My sister was a physics major, Phi Beta Kappa, who's kind of a great mathematical mind. And I called her and I said, what is the probability of this? What is the improbability? She's like, it's impossible. But it did make me feel, and of course I apologized to my mother and she said, you know, she barely remembered it had happened. But I've had very amazing experiences with my faith.
I think that proves it. There is a God.
There you go, everybody.
There it is. We have finally.
But he likes me better than you.
Okay, on that note, I think it's time for questions from the audience. Am I right? Yes.
Don't come in unless you're just homeless and don't want to be here. Yes, ma'am, up there.
You have to wait for the mic to come to you.
Wow, thank you very much. Thank you both. At a time when those of us who were raised Catholic are and educated about social justice are having a difficult time with the position of the church, do you feel uncomfortable with what the bishops have done with healthcare and abortion, for instance, as I assume women enveloped in the women's movement, or maybe you were? Or
yeah, absolutely I do. But I also am impressed with Jerry Berrigan, you know, the 90-year-old former Jesuit, was just arrested 6 months ago and went to federal penitentiary for protesting at a nuclear arms place. And also people in my parish, you know, bring people from El Salvador and from overseas and bring them into their homes. And I mean, every church and temple and mosque has a tradition of charity. The Catholics don't have a corner on it. But there is a nice tradition in the laity, among the laity, of working with the poor. And the church I go to in New York, they have a soup kitchen where you can work. And they have gay and lesbian masses. There are a lot of things about the church that I found that where priests just don't do this stuff. A lot of priests I know do open communion. In fact, I would say every priest I know in the current church opens communion. I think they might preach differently, but in practice, there's that Vatican II loophole of informed conscience, right? Do y'all know about this? This is great. If your conscience tells you to oppose, doctrine, if you think the Holy Spirit is speaking specially just to you, you get to. Mostly. You know, I think it's like, you know, so that when you're, I don't know, you know, when your bishop is telling you to burn all the Jews at the stake, somebody might actually say, bad idea. So, yeah, I feel very uncomfortable with that stuff. Yep.
I'd like to know about your sobriety and your relationship with your son, whether he drinks, whether you drink with him.
I don't drink with anybody. I haven't had a drink in 20 years, so I don't drink with anybody. You said you wanted to know about my son and my sobriety.
No, it's just hard to raise a kid with your history,
I'm just talking about it's hard to raise a kid when you want the kid to be, like, straight and functioning in the world.
And you weren't.
And you have a history.
No, actually it's not that hard because you're the mommy and they're the kid. It wasn't that hard for me. I said, look, here's the deal. You want to have sex, drink, and do drugs. I want you not to have sex, drink, and do drugs. This is the game. It's not personal. I'm unwavering on this. Eventually, you will have sex, drink, and do drugs. I would like to prevent that as long as possible. It's not personal. But that's what I'm going to do. You know, so that when I go up and I catch him in the attic with six of his, you know, friends, you know, each with a, you know, 40-ounce malt liquor between his knees, and he screams out, I'm not drunk. The one sentence that is always a lie. You know, I said, okay, here is an example, you know, where you don't drive your car. You know, or when he got arrested for marijuana in New Jersey on New Year's and didn't come home, and I thought he was dead in a ditch, and he did not leave the apartment in New York for 30 days without me. It was like he was under house arrest. It was like he had an ankle bracelet. So, as you know, does he bitch and scream, and did he not want to do that stuff? Yeah, and he doesn't drink, but I mean, I would let him tell that story, but that's kind of none of my business. But, you know, in our family, not drinking is kind of like going to graduate school in other families, you know. You know, it's just kind of the next logical step as you, you know, check into rehab. So anyway, yes, ma'am. Does that help? Also, Dooney and I did a great thing with Dev when he was very little. We took him to the graveyard where we buried, you know, two of our four roommates in California were dead. And we took him to the graveyard and said, these are, and we took him to the filling station where Jack-O-Lantern was still pumping gas. And Dev said, yeah, Jack-O-Lantern's been smoking pot every day since y'all were in high school. I said, he's got the same job he's had since junior year, you know. That's a win. Yeah, he's not dead in a ditch. He's not stealing TVs. Go ahead, ma'am. I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you. I remember when you were here for Lara's Club, and I bought the book and you signed it. And I asked you at that time about this period, this polo playing period, and would you write about it? And you really said no. I mean, you were very hesitant. You were very not willing to go there. And I just, my question is, what decisions did you make to do it as a result? I mean, I remember it very clearly.
I turned down just under $1 million to write this book from two different offers and turned it down. And that was, again, partly a prayer, which, you know, my Republican sister thought I'd lost my mind. You know, my agent said, that's a lot of change to leave on the table, Mayor. So I didn't know how I'd be able to write about the marriage or about the spiritual stuff without sounding like, you know, who's the guy, Joel Ornstein, you know, like, put your hand on the television and send me a dollar, you'll be rich. So I didn't know how to do it. And at one point, I was in Prague, actually, and I started writing that letter to my son, and I had an idea about how to write the book, and which changed. I threw out over 1,000 pages of this book, by the way, before I got to this draft. And coming back from Prague, I stopped in London. I went to a party, and it so happened that one of the editors, now working in London, was at this party, as was my agent. And I said to the editor, remember that book you tried to buy like 3 years ago? I think I know how to write it now. And she's like, great, I'm coming back to HarperCollins. I want a proposal next week. And that for me is the way prayer has worked in my life. And I know this sounds insane. It's like I'm doing card tricks on the radio, you know, talking about this shit to a secular audience. So apologies. But it does show you how nuts I really am. But is that things come together in this very easy way when I have a sense that it's the right time. It could just be your good self or your intuitive self, or, you know, for me it's a higher power thing, but that's how I came to do it. Baby Jesus told me to write it. Yes. Sanders! Yeah. Oh my God, Sanders, we did acid together.
Is this on? Is this on? Okay. That's why he's laughing. I was going to ask you, This goes back to the period of when you wrote the book Cherry.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember when you were standing in line to see the Jimi Hendrix movie Rainbow Bridge?
Yeah, Rainbow Bridge with Terry Ubrey. I just saw Ubrey in Austin. We were just talking about this. We saw your daddy, right? Didn't we see your daddy?
Yeah.
We were there on LSD.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. Snoopy, we called his daddy.
That's because he'd always try to spy on us.
He was spying on us.
And he had the little pipe like Sherlock Holmes. And so whenever Terry...
I love Sanders.
Whenever Terry calls me or writes me, he'll go, just like my dad, "Well, Ken, puff, puff." You know, it's like the caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland. I better let you...
No.
No, he's too shy.
Do you have a question, Sanders, or are you just saying?
Well,
good to see you.
No, I just wanted to say it's an honor to see how you've risen in the, whatever you would call it, the book writing world.
Let me tell you, the fact that none of us are in the penitentiary is a fucking miracle.
Oh, yeah.
Let's tell the truth.
Me included.
Yeah, I know. We could have all been in the pen more than once, you know.
And what I wanted to compliment you on, and also in Cherry, is the dialogue between Dooney
and Joey Head.
Yeah. You nailed it. Because when I first left Port Arthur, I lived in Vegas for a year. And I was in a band. And they wanted to come back to Texas to get gigs. And Terry flew out to Vegas. And he said, "No, you should go to California and look up Dooney and Joey Head." So I stayed at their apartment for about a year.
Well, that was a crazy place.
And they would let me sleep on the couch in the den. And I could hear Dooney and Joey Head in the other room with that dialogue right as I was about to go to sleep. One would start on the other, and then it'd go back and forth and back
yeah,
and forth.
Yeah, they're crazy. Thank you, Sanders.
As usual, I'm talking.
Shout out to Kenny. I remember that. I was just talking to Ubrey about running your daddy at Rainbow Bridge in Houston with the Jimi Hendrix movie on LSD. Yes, ma'am. Or yes, sir. Ma'am. Oh, there you are.
Hi, thanks a lot for saying that you wrote the book for the money, you know.
I did.
And I wonder if your abiding faith gives you the courage to tell the truth today.
I hope it does. I mean, this book was so hard for me. It took me 7 years to write it. I tried not to write it for 3 years, and then it took me 7 years to actually write it. And I threw out more than 1,000 pages. And one of the things I did, I really freaked out because it was January 2008, and I was 4 years late. I just found out Mona Simpson's 7 years late. I'm really pissed that I crumbled so soon. But when they give you money, they become very interested in when you're going to deliver. And at one point, I said to my agent, I was getting so much grief for having thrown these pages away instead of just going with it. I'll sell this apartment and give them the damn money back before I'll have a gun to my head like this. And I met with a friend of mine who was a Jesuit, and he said a great thing to me. He said, "What would you write if you weren't afraid?" Which is still a question I can only answer on like a daily basis, you know, because I'm afraid of different things depending on which particular way I'm insane on that day. But yeah, I think it did. I pray before I write. I wish I could say God guided my hand like Paul, but no. But I do get a sense, it's just a sense south of my neck. Up here it's like chittering chimpanzee brain. And it's something south of my neck that's very quiet. And I know this sounds insane. I'm sorry. I'll start snake handling soon. Hello. Rick Shope! Oh my God, how are you?
I am doing great.
You remember when I was the poet laureate of Minneapolis, remember that?
Of course. And dancing, rock and roll dancing. Listen, I'm one of the loose marbles that rolled out here to
Good.
LA from Minneapolis.
Good.
It's so delightful to see you. I haven't seen you since then, but I've been aware of your career here, so it's really great seeing you and hearing your story. And I just wonder if you just reflect a little bit from those Minneapolis days, if any story that comes to mind.
Oh, the Minneapolis days. I was so drunk when I was in Minneapolis. I was very good friends with a band called the Suicide Commandos. Some of you might remember as a sort of punk band. And we were just drunk a lot. And I would do whatever cocaine was offered. So it's funny. And I was in graduate school. The only way I could not drink was not to get out of my apartment. That's what I remember, was that I had, like, I would go, like, months at a time and not get out of my apartment in order, because I was in graduate school, too, in order to get my graduate work done. So I don't remember it as, like, a joyful time. I'm sorry. Sorry. I was a great storyteller. Good for me. By God. Pete Carr's daughter. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Are you going to record this because you have such a wonderful...
Are you going to record this because you have such a wonderful voice and a wonderful way
of telling... Am I recording the book?
Yeah.
I am. You know what? They had somebody else record it. I've recorded the other two books. I had somebody else record it. And I said, send me an MP3 of it because I didn't approve this. Mm-hmm. And I recorded the other two books and was actually nominated for something for the second book. And it went, it was some woman who was like, and then I was really depressed. I mean, somebody just acting her ass off. And I said, oh, my God. Oh, my God. It was like Susie Cream Cheese, you know, does your life story. It was horrible. So I am actually going to have to record it in December as soon as I'm off the road. December 12th. So, yes, thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry, but that is all the time we have.
There's one more question. Can we do one more question right here? Because I like your blouse.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Dufflin, and I'm a writer. And for myself and any other writers, I know exactly who might be listening. You know, there's that little devil on your shoulder that says, every story has already been told. Your story has already been told. And then there's the other voice. And I'm wondering what the other voice said to you to help you get here.
You need money. I mean, you know, you're either going to have to start giving blowjobs at the bus station... You've had too many garage sales, and you've taken these sofa cushions out like one time too many. You know, there's no change on the floor of the car. You've turned out the pockets of every coat you own, and you need some damn money. Was what the voice said, and I think, you know, being a poet in America is so humiliating. It really is. It's degrading, and. And I consider myself a poet, and so it's really hard to hurt my feelings rejecting me because, well, I mean, coming from where we came from, that was sort of usual. I remember Dooney used to go to the bar with a friend, and they would, what was the thing you did with the weights of the women who rejected you? They would add up the weight of how many women have rejected him at the bar that night to how many tons it was by the end of the night. You know, like the way you weigh trucks before they go over certain bridges. I remember that. Anyway, that's all. Thank you. Thanks very much. All right. Happy to sign books.
Also, there's a little donation jar out there if you want to throw some money in. Mary will be signing books. And thank you, Mary, so much. And thank you, everybody, for coming.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.